Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@catholicism.org. That's bam@catholicism.org. I can also be found on Twitter @brother_Andre, and you can easily find me on Facebook. Just search for Brother Andre Marie and you will find me. This evening's show is episode number 143, and I'm calling it The Misunderstood Virtue of Justice. The Misunderstood Virtue of Justice. And this is a solo show. A civilization that has little regard to the cardinal virtue of justice is a civilization that is in trouble. Of all the natural acquired moral virtues, this one is the most foundational in the governing of any society. Indeed, the Catholic Encyclopedia article on the subject of justice says it is the most important of the cardinal virtues. American jurisprudence has noble foundations in English common law, which itself has foundations in the deeper legal and philosophical roots of Christendom, where the medieval legal theory of the scholastics gave us sound principles and procedures for criminal and civil law, as well as for ecclesiastical or canon law. But legal positivism, liberal ideology, rogue judges who legislate from the bench, legislators who do not heed the natural law, and civil servants who disregard the deeper purposes of the positive law have slowly eroded what was once a very admirable system. Now, this is this little opening monologue is inspired by some recent events where I noticed the common thread through several incidents and several phenomena, news items, has been a complete lack or a complete disregard, or at least a near complete disregard, of the virtue of justice, of the purpose of justice. Therefore, I thought it would be good to spend some time talking about exactly what justice is. And in the latter part of the show, I want to discuss some of the sort of the problem cases, examples of how justice is not properly understood. Now, I'm going to begin with reading a sentence. I'm going to do a little exercise here, and I'm going to read a sentence twice, and I'm going to highlight certain concepts when I read the sentence. And then I'm going to read it a second time. When I read it the first time, I'm going to highlight certain concepts. When I read it the second time, I'm going to give those concepts in their Latin form. It'll become very obvious why after I do it. Okay. The purpose of the Code of Canon Law is to maintain justice in the church and make sure that the rights of the faithful are protected. So I highlighted the words Code of Canon Law, justice, and rights. Now I'm going to read the sentence a second time, and I'm going to give the Latin for those words that I highlighted. The purpose of the Code of Canon Law, Codex Juris Canonici, is to maintain justice, justitia, in the church, and to make sure that the rights, jura, of the faithful are protected. So those words, juris, justitia, and jura, obviously all come from the same root. There's a Latin word, jus, I-U-S or J-U-S, which is the word from which are derived all those other words. Now, there is the word in Latin for law that's lex, but the Code of Canon Law, the proper name of it, uses another word in Latin for law, and that is juris. Codex Juris Canonici. And it comes in that same word, jus juris, which means it can mean right and it can mean law. And then justice comes from justitia, right? It comes from that same word, jus. So the Latin word for right is also the word for law, and in it is buried the word for justice. So it's no surprise then that the Christian concept of justice, meaning sanctifying grace, meaning made interiorly right, is also called righteousness. There's a connection between these concepts. At a fundamental level, use means right. And we're made right, as in not wrong. And we also have rights, as in things that, to which we are entitled. And the law, the use, protects that. And when that order is working well, we say that we have an order of justice. So this is the great genius of the Latin mind to give us these concepts. Remember, we say ab occidente lex, from the west comes law, and ab oriente lux, from the east comes light. So we're going to talk not so much about law per se, but about justice. Now, of course, it entails necessarily, given the connection, some reference to law, some reference to, for instance, the natural law. And if you don't have a concept of the natural law, you cannot possibly have a concept of justice. Now, I'm not saying if you can't define natural law, that means you can't be a just person. I'm simply talking about concepts in the mind and getting them clear and thinking rightly about them. Some people do good sort of instinctively because they're good people. They have a certain connaturality with virtue. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is when the ideas get muddled and we act based upon those muddled ideas. So now we see the connection between law, right, and justice. Now let's give a basic definition of justice, and let's define some specific forms of justice so that we grasp them clearly and so that we make sure that we don't confuse them with each other. Because if you confuse them with each other, you could become anything from a communist to a socialist, which amounts to the same thing here, to a totalitarian despot. Of another sort, of say a national socialistic sort, or you could become a libertarian who thinks that everybody has all rights to deal with other individuals, and no state has a right to deal with us qua state. Okay, so it's important that we will distinguish three forms of justice, three parts of justice, as St. Thomas would call them, and that we not confuse them, because if we confuse them, well, that's just very bad. Okay, the fundamental sense of justice, the fundamental meaning, I should say, of the word justice is simply to render to each what is his due. Now, when I say due, I could say to render to each what is his right, in which case I'd be using that Latin word jus. Okay, so I'd be burying the root word of justice in the definition of justice. Okay, so you see the connection, to render to each what is his due. That's the baseline concept of what justice is. But I'm going to give you now a textbook definition from the Modern Catholic Dictionary by Father John Hardin. Father Hardin's very useful here because he gives definitions that are extremely scholastic, but then at some points he incorporates modern ideas, and I think it helps to form a contrast. So let's look at the basic definition that he has of justice per se, just justice simply considered. As a virtue, it is the constant and permanent determination to give everyone his or her rightful due. It is a habitual inclination of the will and therefore always recognizes each other's rights under any and all circumstances. The rights in question are whatever belongs to a person as an individual who is distinct from the one who practices justice. Now, interestingly, he goes on to contrast it with charity, which I think is very important. The essence of justice, then, as compared with charity, consists in the distinction between a person and his or her neighbor, whereas charity is based on the union existing between the one who loves and the person loved, so that the practice of charity regards the neighbor as another self. So remember, our Lord said, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, charity makes you do what is for the good of the other. It's wishing him well, and you're wishing him well as you would wish yourself well, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's entitled to it. In other words, charity goes over and above justice. Justice has to do with what are his strict entitlements. And I've seen this in my dealings with some Catholics. They think that because they exercise charity and they do works of supererogation, that is things that are over and above what's obliged of them, they can get away with being unjust. No, you have to pay your just debts, for instance. You have to pay your debts to society. There are certain debts that you owe. And if you don't render those debts, that is inherently unjust, and no amount of charitable work will make up for that. There's a deficiency, okay? There's a debt of sin that you have incurred by being unjust. Okay, so and that's why I think, in my own personal experience, suggests to me that it's very wise that Father Hardin contrasted charity with justice. So again, justice is rendering to the other what is his due. Now, I want to get the virtue of religion mentioned here, but I want to quickly get it out of the way because we're not talking about it here. We've talked about it elsewhere at great length when we did a show on the Mass, for instance. The virtue of religion is the rendering to God what is his due. So in this case, the baseline definition of justice, which is rendering to the other what is his due, still holds good, right? We just replace the other with, instead of some other human, we replace it with God. So the virtue of religion is rendering to God what is his due by virtue of adoration, thanksgiving, reparation, and petition. These things are due to him, and we have it, of course, perfectly in the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, this act of the virtue of religion. So now, as I said, that's out of the way. I'm not going to talk about the virtue of religion anymore, not because I'm against it or anything, just because it's not the subject here. Now, St. Thomas distinguishes between two concepts of justice, two parts of justice, and later theologians added a third aspect, which St. Thomas probably would have included in one of the other two, but so I'm going to give the threefold distinction that that most scholastics gave after St. Thomas, and then I'm going to give a fourth distinction that's very, very modern, which Father Hardin actually does have in his dictionary. I'm going to sort of critique the definition as I go along. So the first distinction is between commutative justice and distributive justice. This is what St. Thomas spends time on in the Summa, distinguishing these two. And, you know, they sound like big words, but don't worry about it. They're important words, and the concepts they define are pretty clear. So commutative justice basically distinguishes between individuals. It's the justice that regulates the activity between individuals. So here's Father Hardin. The virtue that regulates those commutative justice is the virtue that regulates those actions which involve the rights between one individual and another individual. If a person steals another's money, he or she violates commutative justice. Any violation of commutative justice imposes on the guilty party the duty of restitution, others having to pay it back, right? In fact, strictly speaking, only violations of commutative justice give rise to this duty of restitution. So commutative justice is between one individual and another individual. It's what we normally mean when we speak of justice. It governs all economic transactions, for instance. All contracts between two parties are regulated by commutative justice. So a quid pro quo, that's commutative justice. If I go over to Mike Church and I say, okay, Mike, I have these dozen eggs, and let's agree that we're going to trade this for a bottle of your maple syrup or something. It'd have to be a small bottle because that's really expensive. Let's say we're bartering like in the old days, and we barter some quantity of something Mike made for something that I made. So we have an agreement. Now, even though it's only oral, it's a contract. So if I give Mike the eggs or whatever it is I promised, and he doesn't give me the other thing, that's a violation of commutative justice. Not that Mike would do that, of course. Now, distributive justice is the next. It's the virtue that regulates those actions which involve the rights that an individual may claim from society. So think in terms of those who govern the society distributing to the subjects of that, to the citizens of that society, or if we're looking in the days of a monarchy, it's, it makes much more sense because the monarch was considered above, right? He was a head, and therefore he distributed to those who were under him because they weren't called citizens; they were called subjects, right? They were the subjects of the crown, or the subjects of the queen, or the subject of the king, and he distributed to each what is his due. So when it's the government. When it is the society that's qua society that's distributing things to the individuals of society, those things to which they are naturally entitled, for instance, then we're describing distributive justice. According to distributive justice, the state has three basic duties: to distribute the common burdens and privileges equitably. That is according to a certain condign arrangement, to make it possible for each citizen to exercise natural and acquired rights without undue hindrance. Now, what does that mean? To make it possible for each citizen to exercise natural and acquired rights without undue hindrance. That's where the modern state doesn't seem to know its place. Or that's one of the places. For instance, the family is antecedent to the state, and there are many natural rights that are antecedent to the state. For instance, the father of a family has a natural right to be able to support his family without undue hindrance. We all have a natural duty to profess and to practice the obligations of the true religion. So as soon as the state, exercising its distributive justice badly, either A, makes it impossible for a father to provide for his family. And I don't say they don't give him a job. I'm saying they make it impossible. They somehow put an obstacle in the way of a man earning a living to provide for his family, which is a right that he has. He doesn't have a right to a particular employment. He can't walk into a company and say, you must hire me. I have a right. But he does have a right to by his labor and industry to supply the needs of his family. And if that's hindered in any way positively by the state, that is a violation of distributive justice. Another example would be if the state were to say, no, you can't practice the Catholic religion. No, you're not allowed to teach the truths of the Catholic faith to people in public, maybe in your house, but you can't go around teaching those things to people because it's offensive. If the state were to do that, that would be a violation of distributive justice. You're listening to Reconquest and the Crusade Premium Channel, parts of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie, and we are talking about the misunderstood virtue of justice. And we're talking about this threefold distinction of justice between commutative justice, distributive justice, and I'll soon get to legal justice. But speaking still about distributive justice, so the state has to distribute the common burdens and privileges equitably. So in other words, you know, taxation, which is sometimes necessary to sustain the common good, it is necessary. Inevitably, it will be necessary to sustain the common good and to share certain privileges with the citizenry, that those have to be done equitably. That is, I said before, according to a condign arrangement, but I think a congruous arrangement is sufficient for it to be equitable. To make it possible for each citizen to exercise natural and acquired rights without undue hindrance. So acquired rights, by the way, would be rights that were conceded to it by the state. So the state does give us certain rights. Our most fundamental rights, though, are natural rights. They're natural to us, and they cannot at all be alienated. To foster mutual relations among the citizens for living together peacefully. So that's important. This is a job. This is a duty of the state to foster the concord of the citizenry is actually a duty of the state. So, for instance, when state officials do things to engage in race baiting and to engage in any of these sort of social Marxist agendas which divide the nation and have people fighting with each other, either along ethnic lines or class lines or religious lines even, or ethnic lines, any of that, to do that, to foster that, is actually a violation of distributive justice because the state has a duty to foster concord in the community. And then, let's see, inequitable imposition of taxes, for example, would be a violation of distributive justice. I won't have time to get into it, I don't think, but the concept of equity in law is really, really interesting. And there used to be in English common law, and then we even have it in this country, although it's done differently, what were called equity courts. Equity isn't strict justice according to the letter of the law, but an equity court in England and some in America actually went by a different standard. If there's something that's not part of the letter of the law, but common sense and natural law can sort of intervene and tell you that there's a solution to this, that's what the judge did in equity courts. And originally in England, the judicial system was not directly under the power of the crown, or at least when equity law courts came into existence. The crown itself created equity courts in order for people to get redress from those courts when they couldn't, from the judicial branch of government in England, which was independent of the crown. The idea was that the king wanted to make sure that his citizens weren't unduly offended, weren't given draconian rulings by the strict letter of the law, when common sense and the natural law could intervene where the letter of the law didn't address the specifics of this particular situation. That's the general concept of equity. But I'm going to put a link from the Reconquest page to a great legal definition of equity, and it's a very interesting article that I distracted myself with the other day. It's an important concept in law. And the reason it's so important is because it shows you that aside from positive law, that is, the laws that are on the books, written down, posited by an authority of the government, aside from that, aside from statutory law or court cases, there is also recourse to common sense and the natural law. And of course, some lawyers who are legal positivists would freak out at that very concept. No, we're not into common sense or natural law. We're only into what's on the books in black and white. All right, so moving right along, we have then legal justice. So we've defined commutative justice, which is justice between an individual and an individual. Distributive justice, which is justice as it's rendered from the state or the society to the individual. And now we have legal justice, which sort of works as an inversion of distributive justice. The legal justice is defined by Father Hardin as the virtue that regulates those actions which society justly requires of the individual for the common good. Now, I'm going to stick an asterisk on common good, because common good is so misunderstood these days. According to legal justice, the state may institute just laws and perform such acts as further the welfare of the community. Notice it's the welfare, and we're not talking about welfare as in food stamps and such like. We're talking about welfare as in the common good, the good of the community is served by these just laws. Thus, import duties, fire and traffic regulations, anti-pollution laws, and similar provisions of the state concern legal justice. Now, the way that these, obviously, to have a really just society, all these things have to be in operation. The cardinal virtue of justice is obviously not something that inheres in the soul of the state, because the state doesn't really have a soul. The cardinal virtue of justice can only be practiced by an individual, because it only resides in an individual. But the end of the state is actually the same as the end of the individual, not in the same exact way, but in general it is the same. And we're going to talk about the end in a bit, and what the real common good is comprised of. But this concept of legal justice, therefore, is what I as an individual owe to the state. And there are legitimate ways that an individual can owe the state. First of all, to obey its just laws so that the common good can be achieved. To render proper, import duties, taxes, and such things. Now, I know that I'm speaking in a day when the government knows no bounds. We have virtual unlimited government, the nanny state, and all that. And many of my listeners are going to be very well aware of that because you live with the pain of it every day. But the fact is that in a just society, there would be a place for levying taxes. There would be a place for such things as import duties or tariffs and things of that nature. And this is just. This is what the individual or sometimes a corporation, a body of individuals would be rendering to the state so that the state can provide for the common good. For instance, the state has a duty to protect its borders. Ha ha. We'll talk about that in a minute. And that's true. I'm not ha-haing at it being untrue. I'm ha-haing at it being so disregarded today. The state has a duty to defend its populace from foreign aggression. So, for instance, to have a military. Now, I'm not saying to have a military that globetrots all over the world trying to inflict our superior way of life on hapless people who happen to be brown. That's not the point. But there needs to be an actual common defense, right? So there are certain things that the state has as a duty towards its citizenry, and that's distributive justice. But then there's a correlative duty on the part of the individual to render to the state what is necessary for the state to do that thing. And that is called legal justice. Now, these distinctions are very, very important. If you don't have, quote, legal justice, you're a libertarian, and all of your justice is going to be done you're going to look at society as a network of individuals, and that's it. And you're going to look at the body politic as either a necessary evil or as something which actually shouldn't exist at all. So the extreme sort of libertarian becomes an anarchist. And that's not good. That's not a Christian social order. A Christian social order respects all of these forms of justice because man comes together in a society for a certain purpose. And I'm going to talk about that purpose in a little bit. Sam Guzman makes a great before I get to Sam, let's talk about social justice. Now, this is Father Hardin's definition of social justice. Interestingly, because I think the concept is so convoluted, his definition is very long. He's not usually this garrulous in his definitions. And I don't think you can really define it as a virtue. It's a very vague concept. Social justice, quote, the virtue that inclines one to cooperate with others in order to help make the institutions of society better serve the common good. While the obligation of social justice falls upon the individual, that person cannot fulfill the obligation alone, but must work in concert with others through organized bodies as a member of a group whose purpose is to identify the needs of society and, by the use of appropriate means, to meet the needs locally, regionally, nationally, and even globally. Implicit in the virtue of social justice is an awareness that the world has entered on a new phase of social existence. I feel as if I need some background music at work here, like from Star Trek or something, with potential for great good or great harm vested in those who control the media and the structures of modern society. Christians, therefore, are expected to respond to the new obligations created by the extraordinary means of promoting the common good, not only of small groups, but literally of all humanity. Now, obviously, it's good for certain people to be working for genuine justice at the regional, local, national, and international level. But if this is actually justice, then it's a right. Then you're talking about rights and duties. And if you're talking about rights and duties, then social justice is something that we're all obliged to do. How is a farmer in Vermont obliged to work for international justice? It makes no sense to me that they define social justice like this, to become part of a network of institutions that will somehow help the world out better globally. I believe a lot of this stuff goes back to Pope John the 23rd and Pacem in Terris, when a lot of modern sort of nascent globalist concepts started to creep into the language of the magisterium. And I think it's very, very unfortunate. Commutative justice, distributive justice, legal justice, these are all real forms of justice. These are all things that imply rights and duties. But social justice doesn't give rights and duties. I mean, how do you go to confession and confess, Father, I neglected to join an international community do-gooding organization so that I could advance world peace? You can't. But in all these other things, you actually can come up with confessional matter, and you can actually come up with good things that you can proactively do in order to make a just society where you are locally, huh? Okay, Sam Guzman, the Catholic gentleman, a.k.a., who I've interviewed once early on in the Reconquest program, he makes an interesting comment, and he's not talking about social justice directly, as in this definition I just read, but what he says definitely applies to it. And when you think of the term social justice warrior, this is what Sam is getting at. He said the other extreme is an incorrect extreme view of justice. He says the other extreme is viewing justice as a vague and sentimental desire to help everyone. This is often under the guise of social justice. While social justice is a valid concept when strictly and carefully defined, more often than not, it simply becomes an excuse for political violations of property rights, of private property, the dignity of charitable giving, and even human life in the case of abortion. So you see a lot of liberal Catholic organizations which use two terms, social justice and the common good, constantly. Now, social justice is, even as Father Hardin says here, is a new construction. New is in the 20th century, latter half of the 20th century. However, the common good is an ancient concept which has been abused, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit. But Sam's idea here is that it becomes a vague notion of helping everyone, and it becomes this thing which actually sometimes turns justice on its head. For instance, you look at the USCCB and a lot of the stuff that they agitate for. This is the United States Council of Catholic Bishops, Conference of Catholic Bishops. A lot of the program that they agitate for is for the government to tax people more and more and more and pay for certain social programs. And those social programs dole out the money of principally the middle class, by the way, to people who really don't deserve it. It's this sort of welfare program on steroids that they're constantly promoting, and it's a soft core socialism. I read the comment once on a blog by a very intelligent Catholic observer. He said that Catholic bishops have been socialists practically in the United States practically since the beginning. Now, I think he means the beginning of the Republic, certainly not the beginning of the missionary efforts in the New World. But he might have a point. He might slightly overstate it, but there is a tendency among the Catholic bishops to misunderstand charitable giving for justice. And that's why I distinguish really early on between justice and charity. Charity might impel me to feed a beggar. Charity can impel me to give drink to the thirsty, to do all of the corporal works of mercy, right? But that's corporal works of mercy. Those are not works of justice. In other words, I don't have to confess failing to do one of those works in any one occasion. Why? Because strictly speaking, that person doesn't have a right to my food or to my water or to the clothing that I give him or whatever. Now, you're going to say, wait a minute, that sounds so cruel. Well, no, he doesn't have a strict right to it. And that's where mercy enters in, and that's where charity enters in. But the idea that the poor person holds up his fist and shakes it and says, I have rights, you give me that. That's the origin of revolution. This is the French Revolution. This is the Communist Revolution. The idea that the have-nots may demand of the haves what they have. And that is unjust. That is unjust. Now, frequently the haves have committed injustices, and that's why they have what they have. Okay, I'm not arguing at that point. But I'm saying that to try to create a classless society, which was Marx's purpose, or to try to redistribute wealth through forced taxation, that actually ends up, practically speaking, not harming the rich, but it harms the middle class because the rich have all kinds of clever ways of protecting their money. So let's not confuse justice and charity. Let's exercise real charity, but let's not confuse it with justice. Otherwise, we're going to be telling the poor person, you are entitled to what the wealthier person has. Therefore, you can just take it. Or that it's the job of the government now to create this massive, massive bureaucracy that tracks down and collects the hard-earned money or property of individuals who are trying to work so that they can be just in supplying for the needs of their families, huh? Because a father, for instance, has a duty to provide for his family. If a state in the name of some false social justice robs from him to give to some welfare program. By the way, those programs of the state obviously entail lots of state employees. They have to pay for lots of paper clips, copy machines, paper toner, all the stuff it takes to run a bureaucracy and mostly salaries and buildings, real estate that they need for buildings. All the expenses that go into this government-provided welfare is a huge waste. And it's a fake charity, and it's not justice. So that's why we cannot confuse these things. Social justice is this umbrella term under which so much evil is committed. And many of those evils are committed by Catholics who have a very confused notion of justice. In other words, it's just sort of an extreme view, as Sam Guzman said, of a sentimental desire to help everyone. And I may as well say right at this point that wrapped up in that idea that false idea of social justice is a borderless country. In other words, and this is why you see those same bishops oftentimes clamoring for removing the borders, letting all the immigrants come in. Never mind the fact that the math doesn't work out. Never mind the fact that the country's infrastructure can't supply this. Never mind any of that stuff. Never mind crime rates. Never mind taxation and accountability and the fact that these people come in and they go on welfare and they're not even paying tax, which means that the poor middle class that's trying to pay its own way through life now has to be burdened with them. That's not justice. So when you call that social justice, that is a vile simulacrum of justice. It is not the real thing. Now let's talk about the common good, because this is important. This is very wrapped up in the concept of justice, because the common good is, for instance, what social justice, if it were understood properly, would be oriented towards. It certainly has to do with legal justice. It certainly has to do with distributive justice, working for the good in society. And man comes together in society for a purpose, and I'm going to touch on that purpose in a bit. So according to an author named Aaron Carl Taylor at a website that I will link to, he has a great explanation of the Catholic notion of the common good. As the I'm quoting him, as the foundational element of Saint Thomas's social thought is the concept of the common good. And as this concept is so rarely receives adequate definition today, this brief study will aim to highlight the principal lines of Thomas's thought on the nature and constitution of the common good. According to Aquinas, man finds within himself certain inclinations imprinted by God and by which he is directed towards his final end, namely happiness. The primary inclination which man has, the first precept of the natural law, is that good is to be done and pursued and evil is to be avoided. This follows because, according to Aquinas, evil does not have the character of being, but is rather a lack of being, and therefore good has the nature of an end and evil the nature of a contrary. And so man, created to attain his end, naturally tends towards the good. Following this first precept of the natural law, we discover others. He highlights three fundamental inclinations in man. One, those inclinations which man shares in common with all beings, the preservation of its own being according to its nature. Two, those which he has in common with other animals, such as sexual intercourse, education of offspring, and so forth. And three, those unique to man, namely an inclination to good, to know the truth about God, and to live in society. So these are the goods towards which man as individuals are oriented. What is relevant for our purposes is Aquinas' affirmation that it is natural to man to live in society. The reason for this being is that it is only in this way that man will be able to attain his end. The aim of human society, however, is not merely to ensure the private good of individual citizens. Rather, its aim is to seek the supreme human good, the common good, which is superior to the good of the individual. The concept of the common good is one which is spoken of so often, defended so rarely, defined rather so rarely, that one wonders if most who use it have any conception of what they're referring to. And I think it's true that they don't. Thomas states that, quote, society must have the same end as the individual man, which is, quote, to live virtuously, and through virtuous living to attain to the possession of God, end quote, from St. Thomas. The good of the community is the same as the good of one of its members, that is, the possession of God and beatitude. Schaller notes the incompatibility between this idea and a recent political philosophy, which is the final goal of all human restlessness is calm meditation of the divine majesty instead of a kind of unending improvement as it was for nearly every modern thinker. So in other words, the idea of unending progress and improvement of material society and prosperity, material prosperity, that's the end, that's the common good, that's the end of society. But for St. Thomas, the final good of all human was restfulness, the final good of all human restlessness, in other words, our strivings, is calm meditation upon the divine majesty. So Aristotle himself said that man's happiness consists in contemplation of the truth. And St. Thomas simply supernaturalizes that and says, yes, and the contemplation of truth ultimately is only found in the beatific vision when we see God as he is face to face. Okay, continuing with Mr. Taylor's explanation of the common good. To illustrate Thomas's thought, we might draw an analogy with the human body. It is clear that a healthy heart or a healthy liver, for example, is per se something distinct from a healthy body. Yet the end of the particular bodily organ must necessarily be the same as the end of the whole body, namely, health. Moreover, it is intrinsically necessary for the organ to be part of the whole body to attain that end. It needs to be understood that it is this organic concept of what constitutes the common good articulated by St. Thomas, which underlies modern Catholic social teaching of the common good. And when he says modern Catholic social teaching, he doesn't mean, 2018. He's talking about from the time of Leo XIII on, from the time of the great beginning of the great social encyclicals, where Thomistic thought, where scholastic thought was really enshrined and social questions were answered according to the traditional lines of Catholic philosophy and Catholic theology based upon genuine social theory, genuine concepts of common law, genuine concepts of anthropology, that is the study of man and what is his purpose. So they give the example. They say a prominent American pressure group, Catholics and Alliance for the Common Good, has described the common good as, quote, a balance between self and shared interest. So earlier he indicted it. Let's see. It is this fragmentation of the individual and community which is seen in modern concepts of what constitutes the common good. Now, these are false concepts of the common good, in which all too often the common good is conceived of as being an aggregate of individual interests. That's false. It's not an aggregate of individual interests. Or at worst, an uneasy compromise between conflicting sets of rights. And that's what we see today. You know, liberalism is eating its tail because as one group, one group claims that it has rights, other groups claim that, no, you're violating my right. I have rights of free speech. I can say whatever I want. No, you can't say that marriage is between one man and one woman. So the liberals of the 1960s said they had a right to say whatever they wanted, no matter how vile, offensive, or disgusting it was, contrary to the common good, for instance, destroying the innocence of children. Those are the 1960s vintage liberals. But now the modern liberals say, no, you have to shut up. You can't say anything's going to offend me. Don't make me run to my safe space. So you can't say that I'm a man because I identify as a woman, stuff like that. So these false rights claims are constantly crashing into each other. And that's where you see liberalism sort of eating itself. But real the real common good is not simply an aggregate of individual goods that are clashing with each other. That, by the way, is the basis of Locke and Hume and Rousseau and all of the other very bad modern concepts of social contract theory. This is bad stuff. It's bad jurisprudence. It's bad legal theory. Bad social theory. A little bit more on the common good from Aristotle. In the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle describes the happy life intended for man by nature as one lived in accordance with virtue. In his Politics, he describes, it's a book, The Politics, he describes the role that politics and the political community must play in bringing about the virtuous life in the citizenry. So man comes together in society to live virtuously. This is what even the founding fathers of our republic, Masonic and Deist, as some of them were, actually believed. According to Aristotle, the end goal or purpose of the good of the state is to promote the happiness of the individuals who compose it. It should promote their pursuit of good lives. When the state promotes the welfare of others, it is indirectly promoting their chance of living well. Now, what's a good life? For Aristotle, living well and having a good life means none other than living virtuously. So that's my quick concept of what justice is. You're listening to Reconquest and the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie. We are talking about the misunderstood virtue of justice. So now that I've given a very quick and I think possibly too rapid fire rundown of justice and its constituent parts, let's talk about modern problems. First of all, we're ignoring God's rights in society. God has rights too, you know, and not just the virtue of the virtue of religion. As the legislator of the natural law in society, he has a right to be obeyed. God legislated the natural law by writing it on each man's heart. Each man knows fundamentally what's contained in the Ten Commandments with a specific Sabbatine commandment that's made in the Third Commandment accepted. Everything that's in the Ten Commandments is part of the natural law. Man has that law written on his heart. He knows better. So to steal or any such thing, such as the government does frequently, by the way. These things are contraventions of justice. So when the natural law is not respected, God's rights are violated. Now, in a Catholic society, God has additional rights, but we don't have time for that. That's not our purpose here. So glossing over sin is a violation of God's rights. Just taking a very blithe attitude, a very devil-may-care attitude towards sin, that's a violation of God's rights. Confusing justice and charity. This is a modern problem having to do with justice, and we've already spoken to it, especially when we're talking about so-called social justice. The death penalty. A lot of the argument over the death penalty and the Pope's new pseudo-magisterial editing of the Catechism of the Catholic Church contains concepts of justice which aren't traditional. And the dignity of the human person, the intrinsic dignity of the human person, becomes an obstacle to the exercise of justice in this case. A man, as Pope Pius XII said, who commits capital crimes, commits murder or violent rape or something like this, the state isn't taking away his right to life. He has forfeited it. Pius XII said that very strongly and more than once. The man has forfeited his right to life, just as the man who commits some lesser crime may have forfeited his right of free association and free movement. We have a right of free association. We can go where we need to go and associate with whom we need to associate with. But yeah, that can be taken away from us and when we're thrown in the clinker, when we're put in prison so that society may be protected by us and so that we might pay a debt to society. Hell, I mean, I'm not saying hell is an exclamation. Oh, hell. I'm saying hell, the reality of hell, the truth of hell, the doctrine of hell, having been dissolved. It really has to do with the concept of justice, because when we have violated God's rights by sin and we have not repented and made it right, made it jus, and ourselves having been made righteous, just, restored to sanctifying grace, which is also called justification or justice, then we don't go to heaven. We go to hell to be punished. It's a place of punishment, and a punishment is what we get when we when the order of justice is violated. Now, Sam Goodsman makes a point, makes it very well, that justice is essentially a positive thing. We render to others their rights, and we can do this in a way that's meritorious and good and productive and fruitful and makes for a just and society and a society that has concord and amity and all the wonderful blessings that come on a society when everything's working well. But if you don't have justice, you don't have those things. So when we violate the order, we get punished. Justice isn't strictly a matter of punishing, but when the order of justice is violated, then a punishment ensues. And that's why the doctrine of hell is there. Now, of course, when we concede to sodomites and other and unnatural women the use of the word marriage, and when we give them the so-called legal right to adopt children, as is done in, I think, almost all states now, this... Of course, that's by federal legislation that sodomite marriage is allowed in every state. Some jurisdictions didn't have it. Some states didn't have it, but Obama's federal government imposed it. So these are violations of justice. This violates not only the rights of real married people who have a right to that word, whereas other people don't, but it violates the rights of children. It violates God's rights because it violates the natural law. So there's a lot of violation of rights going on there, yet these people say falsely that they have a right to do this. And this is where you get these conflicting claims. Now, how does that have to do with the common good? If the common good of society is that we come together to live virtuously so that we might achieve our happiness, if that's the common good, and that's the real common good, then when you have two sodomites who say they're going to be husband and husband, and they're going to adopt children, that violates the common good because it's a total and complete contravention to the virtue that is to exist in marriage, to the virtuous use of the marital act, to the virtuous use of bringing up children in this world. You know, parents perform a very necessary function for the rest of society. They procreate first, and then they educate the children. Ideally, as their obligation is teaching them the life of virtue, so that they can be a virtuous citizenry. That's a very important role that parents play in society. That's why marriage is the building block of society. Marriage, which is antecedent to the state, is to be protected by the state as one of the state's fundamental obligations. Yet when we concede to two sodomites or two unnatural women, the word marriage, and worse yet, even the ability to adopt innocent children and corrupt them with their sick vice, that is a complete reversal of the common good. That is not the pursuit of virtue. That is not the pursuit of happiness. It's a pursuit of misery. Another example, the false mercy cult. I like to call it the mercy monster. The mercy monster that eats up justice. For instance, Amoris Laetitia, in the famous evil passage of it, where it violates the church's teaching on marriage and says that those who are divorced and civilly remarried, aka not validly married, and who are living objectively in a state of adultery, can receive Holy Communion without confessing their sin. That's a violation of three sacraments: Holy Matrimony, the Holy Eucharist, which is God Himself, and penance, the sacrament of penance or confession. So we've violated three sacraments there, and that's an unjust attack. And it's all done, notice, in the name of mercy. So it's a false mercy that violates justice. Mercy can sometimes mitigate the rigors of justice. For instance, out of mercy, a criminal sentence could be shortened. He might be given pardon and so forth. These are all things that were practiced in the days of Catholic kings, the ages of faith. But that's not a complete violation of justice. It's a mitigation of the full severity of justice. And mind you, this was done in a time when justice was actually severe. Nowadays, we don't have such severe punishments. And by the way, it's only in a society that has capital punishment where it can be seen as an act of mercy when a criminal who is given capital punishment is given a reprieve. When you violate justice, you actually also do away with the real concept of mercy. Mercy only makes sense in a context of a just society. The failure to preach to the Jews, and I'm bringing this up not to be controversial, but I was just reading something the other day where Cardinal Koch, the head of the Office of Ecumenism, whatever they call it, in the Holy See, the Congregation for Interreligious Dialogue, was talking about how the church has no mission to evangelize the Jews. Well, if that's true, and it can only be true in the sense of the official organs of the Holy See right now, doesn't have an office set up to do this. But of course, the church has a mission from God to preach to the Jews. St. Paul preached to the Jews. The apostles preached to the Jews. Even the doctor of the Gentiles, as St. Paul was called, who was a Jew, preached to the Jews and said he would be an anathema, so that is a castaway, so that his nation could convert and accept Christ. So this is an injustice, and it's also a lie, too. Moving on, immigration, I talked about that. You know, poor as borders, a nation has a right to defend its borders. And the Pennsylvania grand jury report, I don't have time to develop this, but many people are wringing their hands over Josh, what's his name? I'm forgetting his name. Josh Shapiro, the AG of the state of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. The thing is an absolute travesty, this attack on the Catholic Church in the state of Pennsylvania. Mind you, there are bishops and priests who are probably guilty, but it hasn't been established. And many of them are dead and have not gotten due process. How is that just? The grand jury process is an exercise in state-sponsored agitprop. It's not justice administered by the state. You've been listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andrew Marie. God bless, and may keep you.